Pinot-4 to confer with neurological experts, especially a Dr. Burkar. Now, 2 years later, she was also suffering from heart trouble and was too debilitated to return home. While Rockefeller applauded her for seeking rest in a warm, sunny climate, he was distressed by her two-year absence abroad. Sensitive to her delicate psychological state, he sent her gently whimsical letters. "I weigh nearly 200 pounds without my 5 wigs," he wrote in December 1905. "You should see them. They are real works of art and most satisfactory. I sleep in one and do not know how I got along all these years without the hair." In spring 1906, frustrated by Bessie's absence, Rockefeller and Seti decided to spend 7 weeks with the Strongs in France, an eternity abroad for these two provincials, at their summer residence in Compiègne, northeast of Paris. That May, Charles had reported that Bessie, "you will be glad to hear, is in better condition at the present than at any time since we came abroad, though we shall hardly be able to cross the ocean this summer." Rockefeller might have seen a sudden chance to deliver a timely plea for Bessie's return to America. In commenting on the trip, George Santayana said of the Rockefellers, "They are going to travel under an assumed name to protect themselves from begging letters and indiscreet curiosity." But Rockefeller might also have wanted to travel incognito to foil efforts to serve him with subpoenas. In June 1906, the Rockefeller party, including Seti, Lute, Alta, and Dr. Bigger, sailed for France aboard the Deutschland, with the Rockefeller name discreetly omitted from the passenger list. When it was learned that Rockefeller was aboard, the press busied itself with speculation about his motives. Some reporters stressed his desire to avoid testimony, and others his supposedly broken health. Perhaps the most outrageous theory came from a New York-American reporter, William Hoster, who conjectured luridly that Rockefeller's stomach was ruined, that he was going to consult a renowned European specialist, and that he might never return alive. Hoping to observe Rockefeller at close range, Hoster purchased a ticket for the crossing, intending to file a series entitled "How the Richest Man in the World Plays." During the voyage, as he stalked his quarry, Hoster was amazed at how different Rockefeller was from the stereotype that he himself had foisted on readers. For one thing, Rockefeller had an excellent appetite and wolfed down 3 meals a day. "It was a distinct shock to me," he later wrote, "when Mr. Rockefeller strolled up the plank, to find him, instead of the hopeless dyspeptic that he had been painted, a tall, broad-shouldered, robust man with ruddy complexion, clear eyes, alert step, and altogether vigorous manner." Far from being aloof, Rockefeller fairly cavorted around the ship, bursting into a dance when he bested Dr. Bigger at shuffleboard, donning a harlequin's costume the night of the captain's dinner, and delighting small children with his antics. One sturdy little fellow one afternoon produced 2 pennies, which he insisted upon sharing with his playmate Rockefeller, Hoster later wrote. "The man of millions gravely accepted the copper and carefully placed it in his pocket. Then, with his face turned seaward, impulsively took up the child and folded his arms about it." This warm-hearted man was a revelation to Hoster. One part of Hoster's assignment was to land an exclusive interview with Rockefeller. When the boat docked at Cherbourg, he knew that the Rockefeller party would shortly roar off in a touring car and that he had to confront the mogul at once. While Rockefeller wandered in an arbor, Hoster accosted him and introduced himself. Though he pretended that he never read his critics, Rockefeller evidently knew Hoster's byline and expressed bitterness at the absurd treatment of his health. Hoster meekly confessed his error. Then, with a reporter's cheek, he asked, "Mr. Rockefeller, have you ever reflected that perhaps you yourself may be in a measure responsible for the way that you have been treated by the newspapers?" He recounted how dozens of times he had gone to Rockefeller's homes to try to interview him but had never been admitted or even allowed a glimpse, which seemed to verify the reports of ill health. Turning to another canard that Hoster had swallowed, Rockefeller noted that he had not been involved in Standard Oil management for many years. "Is it possible that is not known?" he asked. "I have made no concealment of it. All my friends know it. Yet Hoster insisted that he and other reporters were genuinely ignorant of that, and he implored him to make it public. For a time, Rockefeller gazed stonily at Hoster and dug his walking stick into the gravel path. Then his face relaxed and a faint smile crossed his lips. "So it is all my fault," Rockefeller said with a touch of sarcasm. Then, after a pause, he added more seriously, "I suppose there may be something in what you say, though I had never thought of it in that way before." Since Rockefeller had demonized reporters, much as they had demonized him, he was surprised to find that Hoster was sincere and invented stories for lack of accurate information. Rockefeller's attitude toward the press had already begun to evolve with Standard's hiring of Joseph I. C. Clark, which might have predisposed him to talk more freely with Hoster. When Hoster asked if he was worth $1 billion, Rockefeller shot back, "Nothing like it, not by one-third of that amount. I want to make clear to you the injury that is done to me by these persistent stories that I am worth $1 billion. They provoke in the minds of thousands thoughts which lead to great unhappiness." Gradually opening up as they walked along, Rockefeller told Hoster how grieved he was to be transformed into a monster. "Is it not patent that I have been made into a sort of frightful ogre, to slay which has become a favorite resource of men seeking public favor?" As always, Rockefeller blamed business rivals and demagogic politicians for his troubles. Yet, however self-serving his remarks, he was at least now talking to a reporter. Then, to Hoster's extreme amazement, Rockefeller invited him to accompany the party to Compiègne. How could he possibly resist? Charles and Bessie were renting the Château des Avenues at the edge of the forest of Compiègne for the summer. Once the summer home of Queen Isabella of Spain, it was now owned by the Duc de L'Aigle. Despite his wife's illness, Charles was winding up a new book called The Origin of Consciousness. The Rockefellers were heartened to find the 40-year-old Bessie in improved health, though her mental faculties remained gravely impaired. When George Santayana visited during the Rockefellers' stay, he wrote to a friend, apropos of Charles, "It is a terrible life he leads, as his wife is like a child, hopelessly ill, yet apparently not going to die for the present." Unlike Hoster, Santayana was shocked at how poorly Rockefeller looked, old and wrinkled and wearing a pepper-and-salt wig decidedly too small for him. After a lifetime spent escaping reporters, Rockefeller now converted William Hoster into his bosom companion. They rambled through the forest, golfed, and dined together in local hotels. After teaching Hoster how to ride a bike, he took him cycling down the main street of Compiègne, along with his adored 9-year-old granddaughter, Margaret. Hoster was struck by Rockefeller's strong populist streak, how he was intrigued by common people but indifferent to the highborn. In discussing Napoleon, Rockefeller said, "He was a human being and virile because he came direct from the ranks of the people. There was none of the stagnant blood of nobility or royalty in his veins." Rockefeller was entranced by Joan of Arc. "Where did she get her wisdom if it was not inspired of heaven?" he asked. Sightseeing with Hoster, Rockefeller might have begun to taste, for the first time, the pleasures of confession. "They will know me better when I am dead, Mr. Hoster," Rockefeller said one day. "There has been nothing in my life that will not bear the utmost scrutiny." Rockefeller found it impossible during this European idyll to banish thoughts of his tribulations at home. Around the time of his departure from New York, Attorney General Moody had announced the preliminary antitrust investigation of Standard Oil. Then, in early July, Rockefeller received word that a probate court in Hancock County, Ohio, had brought an antitrust action against Standard Oil and issued a warrant for Rockefeller's arrest. The local sheriff had bragged to reporters that he would be on the dock to greet Rockefeller when he sailed back from Europe. George Rogers relayed a message from Archbold, who called the Ohio suit frivolous but advised Rockefeller to extend his European stay. Rogers also reported a new suit in the works in Arkansas. "There seems to be a perfect wave of attacks all along the line," he warned from New York. By late July, the Standard lawyers, reversing their earlier position, pressed Rockefeller to return, assuring him that the Ohio case was targeted against Standard Oil companies in the state, not individuals. As it turned out, Rockefeller was not arrested at the dock, since his lawyers had arranged for him to testify voluntarily in the Ohio case. Having booked return passage on the America for July 20, 1906, John and Setti yearned to take Bessie with them. Rockefeller and Charles clashed repeatedly over this question. Charles later told William James, "I had an uphill fight to prevent Mr. Rockefeller from taking his daughter back with him in defiance of expert opinion." Rockefeller refused to believe that Bessie was too frail to make the crossing. In the end, somewhat reluctantly, even resentfully, he acquiesced in Charles's decision to keep her in France. Charles might have performed one signal service for him, however. One Sunday afternoon, he read aloud an essay that he had drafted on the duties of rich men, arguing that when people accumulated wealth on a colossal scale, they should then convert that wealth into public trusts administered by trustees for the commonweal. This essay might have strengthened Rockefeller's wish to create a huge philanthropic foundation. Back in New York in August, Rockefeller tried to launch a new era in his relations with the press. In fact, reporters were so startled by his sudden voluble friendliness that one headline declared, "Oil King acts like political candidate." When Hoster published a long, flattering interview with Rockefeller, the latter applauded the fair and square treatment he had received. Deciding to combat ghoulish stories about his patient's health, Dr. Bigger gathered reporters and said, "Mr. Rockefeller is in stronger physical health than he has been in the last 15 years. He is as active and as light-hearted as a schoolboy. The trip has benefited him wonderfully." Though sorry to return without Bessie, the Rockefellers had been encouraged by her progress. And Rockefeller, in Thanksgiving, distributed shares of stock to family members. These hopes were cruelly dashed when word came from France on November 13th that Bessie had suffered a paralytic stroke. Rockefeller wired Charles, "Love, sympathy, hope. Leave nothing undone." He took comfort in the thought that Bessie had a good doctor, an attentive husband, and a loving daughter. But the next day came the dreadful wire from Charles. "Bessie passed away at 2 o'clock this morning without suffering." Deeply shaken, Rockefeller replied, "We all send love. All is well with dear Bessie. Command us for any service. Father." By a ghastly coincidence, this news arrived just as the government began to prosecute Standard Oil under the Sherman Antitrust Act. When Bessie Strong died, so little was known about this reclusive heiress that the newspapers strained to pad out their obituaries, admitting that she was known only to a small circle of family intimates. In late November, Charles and Margaret brought the body back for burial in the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery in Tarrytown. Having lost Bessie, the Rockefellers wanted Charles to settle in America, but he was now a permanent expatriate. As he told William James, "I have never been especially proud of being an American." Fluent in German, Hebrew, Latin, Greek, and French, he wanted to return to Europe, seeing it as the fountainhead of culture. For Rockefeller, American to the marrow, convinced that European society was decadent, such an attitude was incomprehensible. Around this time, when reporters asked whether he might ever retire to Europe, he replied, "The United States can't develop enough drawbacks to make me lose the feeling that there is no place like home." To Rockefeller's immense chagrin, Charles took Margaret to England, where she went to school in Sussex and then to Newnham College, Cambridge. During the next 30 years, Charles took an apartment in Paris and a villa in Fiesole near Bernard Berenson's Itati, living the life of a solitary, melancholy widower. Rockefeller kept renewing his earnest plea that Margaret be educated in New York City, and it became a sore point with him that Charles refused to oblige him. A year after Bessie's death, Rockefeller discontinued all further gifts to his son-in-law, though not to Margaret. He feared that Margaret would become isolated from the rest of the family and was haunted by fears that she would be seduced by a continental fortune hunter. As he bemoaned to Edith, "Margaret is a dear girl. How much we wish she were at school in this country, where we could see her oftener. And when she gets all through with the English school, where are the American acquaintances to come from? I am talking this to her and Charles plainly, but without any encouraging response." Rockefeller worried that Charles was exposing his granddaughter to too many radical secular ideas. That Charles deplored capitalism, advocated trade unions, and favored taxes to rectify inequalities of income. These things Rockefeller could tolerate. But he could not condone that Charles led his daughter away from the church and deprived her of religious instruction. In 1908, Charles told Junior that he had dismissed Margaret's beloved Irish governess, Miss Lawrenson, for introducing religion into their household. "I find that, quite without her fault, Margaret was imbibing Catholic ideas, and there was nothing for it but to make a change, greatly as I regretted letting Miss L. go." Every time that Charles and Margaret visited New York, the Rockefellers tried to lure them back to church, a strategy that probably backfired and fortified their resolve to stay away. During one such visit in 1909, Junior wrote to his mother, "Charles and Margaret took supper with us again last Sunday night and went with us to church as far as the corner of Fifth Avenue and 46th Street. Whether we ever get any nearer or not, time only will tell." More than a decade after Bessie's death, Rockefeller was still jockeying to get Margaret back, asking his son-in-law, Harold McCormick, if he and Edith could use their united influence to get Charles and Margaret to come over here when it is possible to do so. "We want to have Margaret live with us." Before considering the particulars of the antitrust case against Standard Oil, it is worth pursuing for a moment Rockefeller's metamorphosis into a master of public relations. Back at Forest Hill that autumn, Rockefeller did something unexpected. He received, in a suitably jolly mood, a delegation from the American Press Humorists, who were so charmed by his wit that they elected him an honorary member, and then cheerfully boasted that they now had the highest per capita income of any such society in the world. For a long time, Star Murphy and other aides had argued that if only reporters would meet Rockefeller and see him as a father, friend, and neighbor, he would not be so grotesquely misrepresented in the press. Joe Clark invited more reporters to golf with the Titan, and these festive outings, full of gags and banter, invariably produced favorable articles. "I have as my constant companions at golf magazine writers and newspaper men," Rockefeller wrote to Harold McCormick in September 1906. "They say they did not know me before and seem entirely friendly and well-disposed." As he abandoned his fearful attitude toward the press, he loosened up, as if liberated by the change. It formed part of a general development away from the more severe manner of his business years. Leslie's Weekly reported the following year, "At the age of 67, he is growing out of his chrysalis. For the first years of his life, he is beginning to enjoy himself. 2 years ago, he dodged newspaper men. Now he courts them." Virtually every reporter who profiled Rockefeller was surprised to discover a courteous, light-hearted old gentleman. "Never have I known anyone who could approach Mr. Rockefeller in thoughtful little attentions," one impressed reporter wrote. "This is the testimony of all his guests. His worst enemy would succumb to this treatment." In response to this friendlier press treatment, Edith started giving her father giant scrapbooks, stuffed with the hundreds of articles about him that appeared around the world each year. Though he had spurned many chances to respond to Ida Tarbell and declined offers to write his life, Rockefeller now decided to publish his memoirs in Tarbell-like monthly installments in The World's Work. The magazine was an especially safe, attractive forum since its editor, Walter H. Page, was a member of the General Education Board. In February 1908, Rockefeller began to play golf daily in Augusta, Georgia, with the publisher Frank N. Doubleday. Their talks resulted in a string of 7 articles published under the title Random Reminiscences of Men and Events, starting in October 1908. These quaint, superficial pieces were ghostwritten by Doubleday, assisted by Star Murphy. After Doubleday Page published them in book form in 1909, the volume was released simultaneously in England, Germany, France, and Italy. Rockefeller thought this due penance from publishers who were trying to undo past harm when they supposed they were serving the cause of righteousness, as he told Edith. For legal reasons, editing the series required great tact. Rockefeller knew that the Attorney General would be scanning the series for his antitrust suit, and Standard's lawyers rigorously combed every word. At first, Rockefeller wanted to trim the Widow Backus section, citing the petty sums at stake, but Gates rejoined that it was precisely the minute sums that had given the story its hold over the popular imagination. "I doubt if any single libel against you or the company has done more harm," Gates said bluntly. "If a man or a company could do such things to a poor and defenseless widow and for a small sum of money, how relentless must be its spirit and its methods." Bowing to Gates's reasoning, the Titan devoted more pages to Backus than to any of his mighty industrial ventures. For the most part, Rockefeller eschewed controversy in his book. Doubleday wanted to replace the image of the forbidding Rockefeller with that of the easygoing man he had come to know. In the series, Rockefeller struck an avuncular note, presenting himself as an avid gardener and sportsman, telling the reader at the outset, "On a rainy morning like this, when golf is out of the question, I am tempted to become a garrulous old man." He was just plain John, the next-door neighbor. Of his current life, he said, "I live like a farmer away from active happenings in business, playing golf, planting trees. And yet I am so busy that no day is long enough." As always, he tried to seem a model of Christian forbearance, turning the other cheek to unfair attacks against him. "I have had at least my full share of adverse criticism, but I can truly say that it has not embittered me, nor left me with any harsh feeling against a living soul." In Random Reminiscences, Rockefeller described a fair world where strong, hard-working people were rewarded and lazy folks punished. No admixture of tragedy clouded his vision. Despite the swelling tide of antitrust suits, Rockefeller reiterated his faith that cooperation, not competition, advanced the general welfare. "Probably the greatest single obstacle to the progress and happiness of the American people," he intoned, "lies in the willingness of so many men to invest their time and money in multiplying competitive industries instead of opening up new fields and putting their money into lines of industry and development that are needed." Though Rockefeller's memoirs received mixed reviews, they helped to humanize his image. Everyone, of course, was eager for Ida Tarbell's reaction, and she duly delivered a booming cannonade of criticism to a Chicago newspaper. "Listen, there is the Mr. Rockefeller of his autobiography, for whom I have a great admiration. He is admirable, there is no other word, in his quietly wise discussions of the proper setting out of Japanese quinces and blue firs, of the arrangements of geraniums and roses. And then there is the other Mr. Rockefeller, utterly and almost as impersonally ruthless as a whirlwind or a torrent. He has swept through the country a conquering Hun, regardless of all save winning for himself. No, he's not a Hun. The destructive force of him is too intelligent. He is more like Bernard Shaw's Napoleon, great because for himself he suspended the ordinary laws of conventionality and morality while keeping them in operation for other people. He is a mastodon of mental machinery. And would you ask a steam plow for pity? Would you look for scruples in an electric dynamo?" Clearly, the lady had not mellowed. Besides acting as midwife for Random Reminiscences, Doubleday made another valuable contribution to Rockefeller's rehabilitation. As head of the Periodical Publishers Association, He dreamed up the idea of having Rockefeller address a luncheon of New York publishers. In a splendid coup de théâtre, the mogul would be introduced by Mark Twain, the chief satirist of the Gilded Age. As it turned out, Twain was ripe for this venture. In the summer of 1907, his dear friend Henry H. Rogers had suffered a stroke, and Twain had stayed with him in Bermuda from February 28th to April 11th, 1908, easing his convalescence. Twain's favorite daughter, Susie, had died of spinal meningitis a decade earlier at age 24. When Frank Doubleday told Twain that Simon Flexner's anti-meningitis serum, developed at the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, had cut the death rate from the disease from 75% to 25% of those afflicted, Twain was all the more eager to help. Always on good terms with Rockefeller, Twain thought he deserved a fair hearing from the press and was sure he would make a good impression on the publishers. Beyond his affection for Rogers, Twain recoiled at the sanctimonious tone the press often adopted in attacking the trusts. He knew all about Rockefeller's business reputation, but some perverse, irreverent streak attracted him to anyone who was so deliciously notorious. For Twain, a man so universally hated by the American public had to have many redeeming features. When Doubleday asked Rockefeller to meet with the magazine publishers, Rockefeller, now an old hand at press relations, replied, "Certainly, why not? I'm willing to meet and talk with any body of men, friends or enemies." On May 20th, 1908, Doubleday sat at the head of the luncheon table at the Aldine Club, surrounded by 40 or 50 magazine publishers, when the rear door flew open and Mark Twain, Henry Rogers, and the two Rockefellers, Junior and Senior, marched single file into the room. As Twain noted of those present, "There was probably not one whose magazine had not had the habit for the past few years of abusing the Rockefellers, Henry Rogers, and the other chiefs of the Standard Oil." Since Rockefeller had avoided contact with the literati, three-fourths of the publishers, by Twain's estimate, had never before set eyes on him. First Rogers and then Twain gave brief introductions before Rockefeller got up to speak. His talk, illustrated with moving anecdotes, described the work of the RIMR. Rockefeller was still a tall, imposing man, yet there was now a touch of melancholy in his eyes. And it was a sadder, more reflective face that stared out at the magazine publishers. The next morning, Twain, who had no equal himself on the lecture platform, jotted down this tribute. "Mr. Rockefeller got up and talked sweetly, sanely, simply, humanly, and with astonishing effectiveness, being interrupted by bursts of applause at the end of almost every sentence. And when he sat down, all those men were his friends, and he had achieved one of the completest victories I have ever had any common knowledge of." Then the meeting broke up, and by a common impulse, the crowd moved forward, and each individual of it gave the victor a hearty handshake, and acted along with it some hearty compliments upon his performance as an orator. It was an unlikely triumph for a reclusive man who had refrained from public speaking and had fled from the press for so long. Unfortunately, he had turned this skill to advantage much too late, since the political assault against Standard Oil now headed inexorably toward its finale. Chapter 27. Judgment Day. On November 18th, 1906, the federal government filed suit in Missouri to dissolve Standard Oil under the Sherman Antitrust Act, naming as defendants Standard Oil of New Jersey, 65 companies under its control, and a pantheon of chieftains, including John and William Rockefeller, Henry Flagler, Oliver Payne, John Archbold, and Henry Rogers. They were charged with monopolizing the oil industry and conspiring to restrain trade through a familiar litany of tactics. Railroad rebates, the abuse of their pipeline monopoly, predatory pricing, industrial espionage, and the secret ownership of ostensible competitors. The proposed remedy was sweeping, to break up the massive combine into its component companies. As a government report documented in 1907, the Standard Oil Leviathan still refined 87% of all kerosene, handled 87% of exported kerosene, marketed 89% of domestic kerosene, and was more than 20 times the size of its most serious competitor, Pure Oil. After the suit was filed, Standard officials tried to sound sanguine and could not subdue their now delusional sense of invincibility. In a letter marked strictly confidential, Rockefeller told Archbold of reports that the Justice Department had scant evidence in its own case, and that it was just a flimsy vendetta worked up by Roosevelt. This program is the usual topic of his present-day talk with friends, and he shows a disposition that is vindictive. If his suit fails, he means to urge legislation, if he can have it framed, aimed at the same target. There seems little doubt that Standard Oil seriously misplayed its cards with Roosevelt. In January 1907, the president tangled with one of his nemeses, Ohio Senator Joseph P. Foraker, before a crowded dinner at the Gridiron Club in Washington. A stout ally of Standard Oil, Senator Foraker, stiffly resisted measures to regulate business. With patent indignation, Roosevelt excoriated Foraker and the malefactors of great wealth behind him. As he pronounced the classic phrase, some reporters thought his gaze traveled to J.P. Morgan, whereas Morgan's friends insisted that the president eyed Henry H. Rogers, then sitting next to Morgan. The latter were probably right, for Morgan and his client firms had handled relations better with the White House. If Roosevelt treated the Morgan interests, U.S. Steel, International Harvester, et al., more leniently than he did Standard Oil, it was partly because they had submitted to guidance from the Bureau of Corporations and worked out informal arrangements to correct violations. In briefing his father on the antitrust case, Junior relayed rumors that U.S. Steel had pushed Frank Kellogg to target Standard Oil so as to deflect heat from itself. He also mentioned that several Standard Oil executives, including Charles M. Pratt and Edward T. Bedford, thought that U.S. Steel had wisely placated the government, while Archbold had been foolishly antagonistic. Senior preferred to view Standard Oil as vengefully singled out for abuse and claimed that other large corporations went scot-free who were regarded by these ablest attorneys in the land as far more vulnerable than was the Standard Oil Company. By the summer of 1907, the political fight against Standard Oil had spread across a vast, bloody battlefield. With 7 federal and 6 state suits, Texas, Minnesota, Missouri, Tennessee, Ohio, and Mississippi, in progress against the embattled trust. New legal skirmishes seemed to crop up weekly. That year, an Ohio grand jury brought in 939 indictments against Rockefeller and other Standard Oil officers. A bill was introduced in Tennessee to oust the trust on antitrust grounds. Missouri fined and expelled the Waters Pierce Company, and so on and so forth. Approaching his 68th birthday, Rockefeller had never imagined that his twilight years would be so eventful. His fortune had failed to purchase him even a poor man's mite of tranquility. As nominal president of Standard Oil, he was in a bind, responsible for actions he had not approved. In a July 1907 letter that betrayed considerable anguish, Rockefeller again pleaded with Archbold to accept his resignation and release him from his torment. During the next 2 weeks, he repeatedly proffered his resignation, telling Archbold this would free him from several subpoenas. Though he owned 27.4% of Standard Oil stock, 3 times the amount held by Flagler, the next largest shareholder, Archbold turned him down flat, and Rockefeller bowed to his protege's wishes. But the decision did not sit well with him. One thing evident amid the spate of lawsuits was that railroad rebates had not faded as an issue, even though pipelines had governed the oil business for more than a generation. When rebates were again forbidden by the Elkins Act of 1903 and the Hepburn Act of 1906, the public naively assumed they had ended. Then the Interstate Commerce Commission reported in January 1907 that Standard Oil was still secretly accepting rebates, spying on competitors, setting up bogus subsidiaries, and engaging in predatory pricing, the same deadly sins patented by Rockefeller back in the 1870s. Roosevelt and his cabinet thirsted for a test case that would prove Standard Oil's collusion with the railroads and dramatize the twin evils of abusive trusts and scheming railroads. The issue was duly highlighted in a 1907 case in Chicago, in which Standard Oil of Indiana was accused of taking illegal rebates from the Chicago and Alton Railroad. The shipments in question had passed between Whiting, Indiana, and East St. Louis, Illinois, after such rebates were outlawed by the Elkins Act. Rockefeller, we recall, always insisted that Standard Oil took no rebates after they were banned in 1887. The presiding figure in the Chicago courtroom was a gaunt, outspoken judge with premature white hair named Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who, at 41, was newly appointed to the federal bench and later served as the first baseball commissioner. Eager to levy an eye-popping fine against the trust, Landis asked its attorneys for figures on its capitalization and earnings between 1903 and 1905. The Standard lawyers, Landis knew, were in a tight spot. If they furnished the true figures, they might invite a punitive fine. If they withheld them, they would look guilty. On June 26, 1907, the federal district attorney tried to pry loose from Standard counsel John S. Miller a list of employees privy to those numbers. "I'll see you in hell first," was Miller's cordial reply. This riposte backfired. Landis assigned U.S. Marshals to subpoena several Standard Oil officials, including Rockefeller. Flouting the judge's request, Rockefeller again fled and stayed with Alta and Parmalee in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. He instructed the bedridden Setti, by now a battle-hardened veteran, to keep quiet about his whereabouts and send him mail only under the Prentice name. For several days, as the press guessed at Rockefeller's whereabouts, Landis's process server tried to track the Titan through the New England countryside. When Teddy Roosevelt and his attorney general heard that Landis wanted to haul Rockefeller into court, they were greatly dismayed. For if Rockefeller testified in the Chicago case, he might win an immunity bath from possible criminal prosecution in the more important federal antitrust suit. They sent an emissary to Chicago to plead with Landis. "I'd like to oblige Mr. Roosevelt," he said. "I'd do anything in reason to oblige him. But Rockefeller is making a monkey out of my process server, and I'm going to bring him before this court to vindicate its dignity." Rockefeller must have discovered the legal advantages of testimony, because he suddenly contacted Judge Landis from Pittsfield and voluntarily accepted a subpoena from a deputy marshal. On July 5, 1907, arriving by private railroad car, John and William Rockefeller and Henry Flagler conferred with lawyers at the spacious new offices of Standard Oil of Indiana in Chicago. Instead of cooperating with Landis, Rockefeller counseled defiance and opposed revealing the balance sheets. "But Mr. Rockefeller, times have changed," Flagler said. "The old maxim, silence is golden, doesn't work so well." "Well," Rockefeller drawled, "it did when I was at the helm." Though he had agreed to travel to Chicago, Rockefeller hesitated to appear in court. And when he canvassed the lawyers present, they seemed to side with him. Then he sounded out the youngest lawyer, Robert W. Stewart, who said, "Mr. Rockefeller, in view of the opinion rendered by the distinguished legal talent present, I hesitate to express an opinion." "Young man," Rockefeller said, "I'm paying you to give me your opinion." Summoning up his courage, Stewart said, "Mr. Rockefeller, you are no different from any other citizen before the law, and if I were you, I would appear." For all his tough talk, Rockefeller was smart enough to abide by the young man's advice. On the sultry morning of July 6, 1907, John and William Rockefeller arrived at the federal building and found streets teeming with hundreds of spectators. When Rockefeller was spotted in a straw hat grasping a slender cane, somebody shouted, "Here he comes!" The crowd surged forward in such close ranks that it took a squad of 20 club-wielding detectives to clear a path. Rockefeller grinned when a street urchin called out, "There's a man who got his picture in the paper." Some zealous onlookers tore buttons from Rockefeller's coat. By the time the Rockefeller brothers reached the sixth-floor courtroom, a red-faced Williams, sweating profusely, muttered, "An outrage! I never heard of such treatment!" By contrast, John D. exhibited his usual cool demeanor before an unruly mob. When he entered the sweltering courtroom with electric fans slicing overhead, he even imitated a reporter trying to take notes in the crush of people. Once the doors were closed, the hum of spectators outside was still so loud that policemen had to clear the corridor. After the marshal brought down his gavel, Rockefeller began 15 minutes of unforgettable testimony. A virtuoso of evasive testimony, he was the tranquil eye of the storm. As one reporter noted, Mr. Rockefeller was the coolest-looking man in the room. Every motion he made was slow and dignified. His step was slow. His replies to the questions of the court were even slower. Judge Landis, itching to interrogate Rockefeller, had not reckoned on his incomparable mastery of prevarication and selective memory laws. Once again in the halls of justice, Rockefeller turned himself into a confused old dotard. The most modest question seemed to pose insurmountable challenges to his mind. To start things off, Judge Landis asked, "Mr. Rockefeller, what is the business of the so-called Standard Oil Company of New Jersey?" "I believe, Your Honor," Rockefeller began, then appeared to lose his way. He paused, fiddled with his cane, crossed his legs, then made a second stab at an answer. "I believe, Your Honor." Here again his mind wandered as Judge Landis tapped his spectacles on his desk in frustration. Finally, Rockefeller concentrated his faculties and replied, "I believe, Your Honor, they operate an oil refinery in New Jersey." To all questions, Rockefeller responded in the same slow, disconnected style, making his testimony worthless. In exchange, Landis had to give Rockefeller the one thing he dearly wanted, immunity from criminal prosecution. This testimony was not only a fiasco for the judge, but a public relations victory for Rockefeller. How, people wondered, could this sweet, bumbling old man have been the evil wizard of the trust? His testimony even received plaudits from the press. As he told Archbold afterward, "My experience at Chicago and with the newspaper people generally of late has been very satisfactory." A month later, Judge Landis took his revenge. On the morning of August 3, 1907, as more than 1,000 people sought entrance to his courtroom, Landis read aloud his decision in the Standard Oil case. Possibly in anticipation, Rockefeller had just announced a $32 million gift to the General Education Board. Once again, with difficulty, the marshals shut the great doors to keep out waves of spectators. Pale and edgy, Judge Landis called Standard Oil no better than a common thief and castigated its lawyers for their studied insolence. As spectators guffawed at these insults, the bailiffs repeatedly had to rap for order. Then Landis delivered his bombshell, a fine against Standard Oil of Indiana, that dwarfed any other in American corporate history up until that time. $29.24 million, $457 million in 1996 dollars. This was the maximum penalty, $20,000 for each of 1,462 carloads of oil cited in the indictment. Reporters struggled to convey the magnitude of this fine. That money could build 5 battleships, fill 177 flat cars with silver dollars, employ 48,730 city street workers each year. It amounted to slightly more than half the money coined annually by the federal government. Since it represented nearly 30% of Standard Oil's $100 million capitalization, Rockefeller's theoretical share of the fine worked out to $8,011,760. Asked about the penalty, Mark Twain said it reminded him of the bride's words the next morning. I expected it, but didn't suppose it would be so big. Rockefeller used the record find to put on a characteristic show of aplomb. He was in the middle of a golf foursome in Cleveland when a messenger came sprinting across the fairway, clutching a yellow envelope. Taking it and handing the boy a dime, Rockefeller read the verdict without even a twitch. Finally, he put the message in his pocket and said to his golf partners, "Well, shall we go on, gentlemen?" Then he hit an excellent drive of about 160 yards down the fairway. At first, nobody dared to ask the question on their minds, but then one person screwed up his courage. "How much is it?" $29,240,000, the maximum penalty, I believe," Rockefeller answered coolly. Then he gestured toward the tee and said, "It is your honor. Will you gentlemen drive?" By all reports, Rockefeller was in superb form that day and completed 9 holes in 53 shots, his best score ever. The next day, in relating the incident, one Cleveland paper said, "Not by change of countenance or movement did the Standard's founder betray the fact that he might have been annoyed or angered by the sentence handed down in Chicago." Of course, Rockefeller's poker face concealed deep rage. The Landis find supported the thesis that the Standard Oil Empire was based on unethical, even illegal rebates, not on the business acumen of its founders. Before the day was over, Rockefeller issued a statement upbraiding the court. "A great injustice has been done the company. It was from ignorance on how the great business was founded. For all these years, no one has known and no one seems to have cared how it came into existence." Descrying Teddy Roosevelt's influence, Gates told Rockefeller that he had lost his admiration for the man and hoped that "this amazing and reckless robbery and plunder under the forms of law may awake the business interests of the country and thoughtful men to the perils into which we have drifted." At one point during that famous golf game of August 3, 1907, Rockefeller remarked, "Judge Landis will be dead a long time before this fine is paid," and his prediction proved accurate. He seldom spoke so harshly in public. Many observers saw the Landis fine as more of a political statement and a publicity stunt than sound jurisprudence. In July 1908, a federal appeals court not only revoked the fine, but severely reprimanded Landis for considering each carload of oil as a separate offense. Judge Peter S. Grosskopf, calling Landis's act an abuse of judicial discretion, ordered a retrial, in which Standard Oil was subsequently found not guilty. Teddy Roosevelt was hopping mad at the appeals court. While he had thought the Landis fine excessive, he had thought the trial itself fair. The day after the fine was thrown out, Roosevelt announced that the government would again prosecute Standard Oil for accepting rebates, since "there is absolutely no question as to the guilt of the defendant nor of the exceptionally grave character of the offense." Dismayed, he said with a touch of bombast that the decision had "hurt the cause of civilization." By the early fall of 1907, many Wall Street soothsayers were predicting a savage downturn in financial markets in response to the Landis fine and the antitrust suits. "It must be that these persecutions against business interests will not always continue," Senior warned his son in late August. "If so, we must be prepared for very disastrous results to our commercial fabric. I think we better increase our reserves of money with our income." In the week after the Landis fine, Standard Oil shares skidded from 500 to 421, leading a stock market slump. For reform-minded critics, the ensuing panic originated with the misbehavior of the business fraternity itself. For several years, the stock market had coasted on a tide of easy money, low interest rates, and manic speculation in copper mining and railroad shares. In this euphoric mood, stock promoters had flogged unsound companies, and investors had gorged themselves on watered stock. Among the most flagrant speculators were trust companies that exploited legal loopholes to speculate heavily in the stock market, while also lending excessively against securities as collateral. Roosevelt inveighed against "an era of overconfidence and speculation," that would lead to a severe purgative reaction. As money tightened that September, Rockefeller deposited in several New York banks bonds that could be pledged as security for government loans, a rescue operation for which he reaped a handsome 2% commission. As panic overtook Wall Street in late October 1907, throngs of petrified depositors lined up in front of banks to empty their accounts, and J.P. Morgan rushed back to New York from an Episcopal convention in Richmond. On October 22nd, after his aides examined the books of the Knickerbocker Trust, Morgan decided that it was hopelessly insolvent and had to be shut. That night, in an extraordinary pledge of faith in a private citizen, Treasury Secretary George Cortelyou met with Morgan in a Manhattan hotel and placed at his disposal $25 million in government funds to stem the panic. While Morgan was the impresario of the salvage operation, Rockefeller provided more money than anybody else. When Gates got wind of the Knickerbocker's collapse, he telephoned Rockefeller at Pocantico in the early morning and said a public statement from him might restore confidence. Rockefeller stood there in his bathrobe, mulling over the matter, then decided to call Melville E. Stone, general manager of the Associated Press. He told Stone, for quotation, that the country's credit was sound and that, if necessary, he would give half of all he possessed to maintain America's credit. It was an unprecedented statement. A single citizen had promised to bail out Wall Street. The next morning, as these sedative words were reprinted across America, reporters spilled onto the golf course at Pocantico. When asked if he would really give half his securities to stop the panic, Rockefeller replied, "Yes, and I have cords of them, gentlemen, cords of them." It was a rare case of Rockefeller boasting about his wealth, but it was clearly meant to lift public morale. Because Rockefeller deposited $10 million there, National City Bank had the deepest gold reserves and cash resources of any bank during the panic. "They always come to Uncle John when there is trouble," Rockefeller noted with pride. When J.P. Morgan decided to save the shaky Trust Company of America on October 23rd, he received $3 million in rescue funds from George F. Baker of First National Bank and James Stillman of National City Bank, the latter drawing on Rockefeller money. For the first time in several years, John D. Rockefeller Sr. strode through the portals of 26 Broadway on October 24th and took up his command post. "I was surprised to find so many men who had come to the front since my last visit years ago. Afterward, I had an opportunity to talk with old associates and many new ones, and it was a source of great gratification to me to find that the same spirit of cooperation and harmony existed unchecked." Rockefeller offered his services to J.P. Morgan, and his millions formed part of the $25 million fund that Morgan marshaled that day to keep the stock market open, averting the bankruptcy of at least 50 brokerage houses. Whatever his personal distaste for Morgan, Rockefeller generously praised his leadership during the 1907 panic. "His commanding personality served a most valuable end," he wrote in his memoirs. "He acted quickly and resolutely when quickness and decision were the things most needed to regain confidence." Several family members sought Rockefeller's help to withstand the storm. He bought $4.5 million of International Harvester stock from the cash-strapped McCormicks and extended a huge $7 million loan to his brother William, who was hip-deep in stock market maneuvers. Even with a brother, Rockefeller could not suspend standard business practices. Frank had already learned that, and he asked William to furnish a list of securities as collateral. But when Rockefeller's advisor Henry E. Cooper demanded more, it prompted an ironic reminder from Rockefeller. "Well, Mr. Cooper, don't be too rigorous. Remember, William is a very rich man." With full-blown panic raging around him, Rockefeller refused to depart from his daily schedule for long, and after his one day at the office, he returned to Pocantico to play golf. During his morning game, he was interrupted repeatedly by urgent messages, and each time he pedaled his bike back to the carriage house and made another enormous pledge to stave off trouble. He then resumed his game with his usual sang-froid and air of unconcern. During the 1907 panic, Rockefeller, for the first time, appeared civic-minded to the general public and garnered lavish praise. As he told a relative, the newspapers had spoken very kindly and favorably, and all have shown great appreciation of what we have tried to do to save the ship. For a time it seemed this goodwill might moderate the antitrust zeal against Standard Oil, but this hope soon evaporated when Rockefeller told a reporter, "The runaway policy of the past administration can have but one result. It means disaster to the country, financial depression and chaos." According to Rockefeller, he made this statement off the record and professed pity for the errant reporter who published it in violation of his solemn oath. The comment aggravated the hostility that President Roosevelt already felt toward Rockefeller, especially since Rockefeller kept pleading ill health as his reason for not coming to the White House to discuss Standard Oil. Privately, Roosevelt said that Rockefeller felt wounded because the government had published the plain truth about Standard Oil. After the Landesfein was announced, Standard Oil tried to alter its strategy and negotiate a government compromise. That September, it held out a tempting deal to investigators. It would open its books and abide by any recommendations to guarantee compliance with the antitrust laws if the government withdrew its suit. Government officials were caught off guard by this peace offering. "A really astonishing proposal," James R. Garfield wrote in his diary. But Roosevelt was no longer in the mood for a truce. "If we have a criminal case against these men," he told Attorney General Charles Bonaparte, "I should be very reluctant to surrender it." Archbold should have persisted in his conciliatory approach, but he was too accustomed to heavy-handed politics. He was openly contemptuous of all political attacks against the Combine. During the spring and summer of 1908, he held several confidential meetings with President Roosevelt, arranged by Senator Jonathan Bourne of Oregon. The president expressed an earnest wish to see the Standard Oil case settled out of court. While Archbold believed in his sincerity, he also knew that Roosevelt had vacillated on this issue. Archbold then resorted to a typically tactless maneuver. In late October 1907, he had Senator Bourne suggest to the president that if the government struck a deal, Standard Oil would help Roosevelt win renomination in 1908. A horrified Garfield called this brazen offer stupidly corrupt. Because of Rockefeller's helpful intervention in the panic, Roosevelt observed a brief moratorium in attacking Standard Oil, then made up for lost time in January 1908. In a special message to Congress, he complained that "the speculative folly and flagrant dishonesty of a few great men of wealth had engendered the loss of fiscal confidence," and he condemned the "bitter and unscrupulous craft of the Standard Oil leadership in fighting reform measures." The antitrust suit would proceed as planned. Since Rockefeller had created the largest business empire of the late 19th century, it was only fitting that he should face the most massive antitrust suit of his day. Some 444 witnesses delivered 11 million words of testimony. Swollen by 1,374 exhibits, the proceedings filled 12,000 pages in 21 thick volumes. Before it was over, Standard Oil also contested some 21 state antitrust suits from Texas to Connecticut. Leading one historian to comment, "Never before in the history of the United States had there been so far-reaching a struggle between industry and government." To supplement its legal staff, Standard Oil retained John G. Milburn and M.F. Elliott of Wall Street, D.T. Watson of Pittsburgh, Moritz Rosenthal of Chicago, and John G. Johnson of Philadelphia. For its part, the Justice Department brought in Charles B. Morrison, a federal district attorney from northern Illinois, and Frank B. Kellogg, a St. Paul attorney whose success in the case catapulted him to the post of Secretary of State in the late 1920s. Throughout the case, the public fancied Rockefeller to be the all-powerful wire-puller who manipulated Archbold and the other pliant marionettes. If this was sheer fantasy, what then was his actual influence? He did exert limited influence on Standard Oil strategy through the medium of Henry Clay Folger, a Standard Oil director. A thin, bearded man, Folger was diplomatic and extremely diligent in his duties. Unlike the rugged Standard Oil businessmen of an earlier day, Folger had graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Amherst and then attended Columbia Law School. A cultured man, he left to posterity America's foremost collection of Shakespeare first folios, as well as a splendid library. Far more important to Rockefeller was that Folger played excellent golf and joined him on the links every Wednesday morning. In memos to Folger about the suit, Rockefeller never touched on political or legal tactics, but mostly addressed arcane calculations of profitability. Rockefeller wanted to prove that Standard Oil's profits had never been excessive or extortionate. Many other companies watered their stock, that is, issued them at inflated capitalization, so that their dividends appeared deceptively modest. To save on taxes and conform to Ohio law, Standard Oil had kept its capitalization low, which produced misleadingly high dividends of 40 or 50% per year. Rockefeller pegged the real dividend rate at something closer to 6 or 8%. Folger performed statistical analyses showing that with its capitalization more accurately stated to reflect retained earnings, Standard Oil had paid average dividends twice as high as Rockefeller had surmised. I am surprised to find the average dividends for 25 years, 13.86%, the company founder confessed sheepishly to Folger. Rockefeller now had to rationalize the higher figure and suddenly found it within an acceptable range, noting the larger profits of many other large businesses with less risk, including the United States Steel Company. Businessmen will not regard the earnings which you present as excessive, he told Folger. Afraid that militant trustbusters might see things differently, he promised to destroy this incriminating data. He also reminded Folger that Standard Oil had not kept prices low out of altruism, but to deter competition and keep our profits on such a basis that others would not be stimulated to enter the field of competition with us. This belied his frequent claim that his motive was to bequeath cheap oil to the working people. During his Standard Oil tenure, Rockefeller had mollified the public by generally keeping kerosene prices low. But when Archbold took control in the mid-1890s, he kept domestic prices high while depressing foreign prices to diminish overseas competition. During the dozen years before Rockefeller's retirement, the trust's return on assets ranged from 11 to 17%. With Archbold at the helm, returns soared from 21 to 27% between 1900 and 1906. This might have been smart business, but it was very poor politics. The trust was booking record profits just when it could least afford to enrage public opinion. It is no coincidence that Ida Tarbell's series and Teddy Roosevelt's trust busting coincided with Archbold's more grasping regime. He was a much less clever monopolist than his mentor. When Frank Kellogg grilled Rockefeller in November 1908 at the Customs House in New York, much of the testimony concerned Standard Oil's pricing policy. Standing by maps showing the operational areas of Standard marketing units, Kellogg tried to entrap Rockefeller into admitting that the cartel had divided America into exclusive sales territories. "Does the Standard Oil of Ohio have a limited territory?" he asked. "It has not," said Rockefeller calmly. "Has it not in the last 5 years?" asked Kellogg. "Not to my knowledge," Rockefeller replied. "Its field is the world. That is its mission, to light the world with the cheapest and best." Smiling and imperturbable, Rockefeller kept glancing for guidance to his lawyers, who continually raised objections to Kellogg's questions. Kellogg tried to show that Standard Oil routinely engaged in predatory pricing, eliminating competitors and then hoisting prices to exorbitant levels. He estimated that true competition prevailed in fewer than 10% of all petroleum markets, and noted that kerosene prices had risen unreasonably from 1895, when Archbold took charge, to 1906, creating widespread consumer discontent. To justify Standard's plush earnings, Rockefeller cited everything from fire hazards to the vagaries of drilling to the need to invest in new fields, to which Kellogg responded with sarcasm. But Standard Oil has been paying enormous dividends right along. Lifting his eyes heavenward, Rockefeller replied, "And we were grateful for it." Once again, the press found it hard to believe that this amiable old gent with his sudden memory lapses and fuzzy logic was the fearsome raptor of Standard Oil. Now that Mr. Rockefeller has emerged from his seclusion and is seen in the fierce light of a public inquiry, he appears no such monster as the public fancy has painted, observed one paper. He is affable to the point of cordiality, said another. If Rockefeller has been playing a part, he has done so in a way that would do credit to Uriah Heep. If not, it is barely possible that the curious old man has been misrepresented, and that the world owes him an apology. Perhaps if Rockefeller had made himself available at the beginning of his career, as he did now at the end,